From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. This week, we're bringing a little arts and culture to the winter doldrums with a sampler of some interesting events right here in Columbia. Today's show dives into a new play premiering this week, an international photography competition, and films you can't miss at True Falls. A new play is premiering this week at the University of Missouri. It's The Green Duck Lounge, written by Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Steve Kraske, who's host of KCUR's Up to Date, interviewed Johnson and Glenn Rice, a journalist who covered the case that inspired the play.
What does the civil rights movement of the 1960s have to do with the Black Lives Matter push of today? Maybe a whole lot. A new play by KCUR's Michelle Tyrene Johnson examines this connection using a prominent local landmark as its touchstone. That place, the Green Duck Lounge, was a prominent gathering place for African Americans and also the site of a pair of prominent murders, including that of the influential Leon Jordan in 1970. The play is titled The Green Duck Lounge, and here to talk about it is Michelle Tyrene Johnson, who covers race and culture here at KCUR. Michelle, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Hey, Steve.
Also here is Glenn Rice, a veteran reporter for The Star, who investigated the never-solved 1970 slaying of Leon Jordan outside the Green Duck Lounge. Glenn, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Michelle, our late friend Mike McGraw, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The Star, encouraged you to write this play, and I'm wondering why.
I think it's more accurate to say he badgered me into writing the play.
over and over again.
Yeah. From the first, literally the first day I met Mick, he wanted me to write a play on Leon Jordan.
He just felt like
Leon Jordan was this really important part of Kansas City history that was not getting the attention and the shine that somebody of his stature and his influence should have. And I'll be honest, I did not know as much about Leon Jordan as I should have. I mean, I knew his name, of course, but Mick would not let up. He would not let up. And then finally, I looked into the Green Duck Lounge and Freedom Inc. I mean, I knew about Freedom Inc. and Leon Jordan.
Leon Jordan was a co-founder of Freedom Inc.,
the
influential African-American political club, right?
He was, and it just came together.
And what are you trying to say here, then, in your play, The Green Duck Lounge?
Well, what happened was in doing my research, just sadly, in between the time Mick and I met and me looking into doing a story about Leon Jordan, the owner at the time of the Green Duck Lounge had been killed. He died, had been murdered a couple of blocks from the Green Duck Lounge at his home.
This is Jimmy Townsend.
Yes, Jimmy Townsend. And in my mind, I just thought, wow, I mean, the parallels of having these two owners of this really influential place be murdered, maybe not for the same reason, but what does that say about how things have changed and how things have stayed the same, particularly in the Black community? And then when I started really sort of digging in deeper, there's such a parallel between the civil rights movement and the kind of conversations, not just that Blacks and whites have about civil rights, but about what Blacks and Blacks have about civil rights. There's a lot of that.
So you find a parallel between Black Lives Matter and the civil rights push of the 1960s.
Exactly. I mean, it's all about equality, making sure that people have the rights that they deserve, the citizenship, equality that we as African Americans have to any other American. I mean, they're the same things, even though the focus may look different.
Glenn Rice from The Star, let me get you in this conversation here. The Green Duck Lounge is at 25th and Prospect. How important a gathering spot was this tavern then? How important is it today?
Then anyone who sought the vote or support of the African-American community, even from those running for governors, for city council individuals, committee persons and so forth, had to go to the Green Duck Lounge and to speak with Leon Jordan to get his support in order for them to be successful in their campaign bids. The Green Duck has always been an icon, landmark in the community. I grew up at 24th and Agnes, so it wasn't very far from that. And Leon cast an enormous shadow even as during my upbringing. Of course, I was only 5 or 6 years old when he was killed, but you grew up knowing who he was and the impact that he had. Today, you know, over the years, the ownership of the Green Duck changed very frequently, and but you still can go there and have that sense of those ghosts of those political paths, bathe over you in their spirits and kind of be encapsulated or even go back in time to imagine how things were back then.
So one night, Glenn, in 1970, he steps out of his tavern, I think, to go home for the evening, and he's shot to death. You and Mike McGraw, we just talked about Mike, the former investigative reporter for The Star, took a deep dive into what happened there and who wanted to see Leon Jordan killed. What did you find out?
We found out that Leon, despite all his great things he did politically and culturally, he had another side to him that he upset some individuals inside the community and outside the community. And as he was walking out, there were three individuals who pulled him to a car. One of them stepped out and blasted Leon a couple of times with a shotgun, left him there in Middle Prospect and sped away. Rumor would be that he upset some very influential people in Kansas City, those who had organized crime ties, supposedly. And so once he had lost curry favor with them, and he wasn't doing what he's supposed to do in their eyes, and so they felt a need to eliminate him. And so there was a store owner who was part of this group that kind of made his way into the community, group called the Black Mafia, and who eventually sold drugs and did other things in the community. And those are the ones who were responsible for Leon's murder. One of them, at least, went to trial. He was acquitted. The others, when charges were not brought upon them. And so when we did our investigation, the police had launched his own investigation at the behest of Alvin Sykes. And so we had parallel investigations, and it turned out that our conclusions were similar to theirs, or theirs were similar
right.
to ours. And so those individuals who were responsible for it, they had died, or they could no longer prosecute them.
What do you want people to discuss as a result of seeing this play?
In the play, I do this thing where I double cast. So half the play takes place in current times, 2015, and then the same actors play different characters in the past. And in doing so, it really underscores the parallel between the issues of civil rights for African Americans. And that makes it almost easier to have that conversation when people can get outside of themselves to have that discussion with fake characters. Because Leon Jordan is the only actually real character in the play. The rest are people I just make up.
Right.
As part of the narrative that I write.
You know, in this play, you deal with these generational disagreements on what it means to be an advocate for the Black community. Describe that to us.
Well, you know, every generation, regardless of race, gets this, how there's always the segment of a generation that believes slow down, go easy, play nice. And then there are the other segments of that population, usually younger, that are like, no, let's break it down. Let's make some noise. And that's always been the case. There's always been Black respectability politics in the Black community where you have people go slow down, take it easy. Let's not upset the white people. And then the folks who go, you know, but upsetting the white people, that hasn't gotten us anywhere. So
Martin Luther King dealt with that struggle every day of his life.
Literally until he died.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's a common interaction, intergenerational, interracial fight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an important one because it's not about one side being right and the other side being wrong. We need all the boots on the ground and in any fight for a greater society to have these conversations.
That was Steve Kraske, host of KCUR's Up to Date. talking with Michelle Tyrene Johnson and Glenn Rice about the play, The Green Duck Lounge. Green Duck Lounge opens on Wednesday, February 21st, and runs through Sunday. This is Intersection on KBIA. Later in the show, we'll hear from the folks at True False about can't-miss films coming to this year's festival. But first, let's hear about a lesser-known, world-class event going on in Columbia right now. Pictures of the Year International is one of the oldest photojournalism contests in the world. Judging takes place every year at MU. This month, expert photojournalists are judging 40,000 images from more than 80 countries. Intersection producer Hannah Rodriguez spoke with Lyndon Steele, the new director of Pictures of the Year International.
I first became acquainted with POI as a student here at the university, which was about 25 plus years ago. And so it was my first introduction to the caliber of photojournalism that is being done at the top levels in the industry, and it just kind of blew me away. And so it is very inspiring, very intimidating. And so what it means to me is a connection to my education and a connection to what's best about being a photographer or a photojournalist.
This is your first year as a director, but like you, I'm sure you've been in past to like judging. Have you been to judging in the past?
As a student, I volunteered, I've entered as a professional, as a photographer, as an editor, and I've lost. And so, yeah, I'm pretty familiar with it, like many people are. You can watch it online now. And so it's very common that people will disagree with what the judges think and what they say. And it's been like that since I first became acquainted with the contest, you know, more than two decades ago. I kind of take that as par for the course, right? I mean, there's going to be work that's rewarded. It's going to be held up as this is the best. And if you don't agree with that, you may voice that, and you may be mad, or you may think about it and maybe over time understand their perspective better, or maybe not, but it might lead you to a different perspective that helps your own work. So I think there's value in it no matter what. You don't have to agree with it. But I think we do have to recognize that the people that are brought in to be a judge, you know, are our peers, and they're usually our peers who have excelled in this business. So they bring a perspective, and they bring an expertise and experience that I think is worth listening to.
What do you think it means in, like, the photography world? And I guess explain and describe how, like, what its meaning and purpose is for these photographers and...
Well, I hope it's something that... if a photographer is celebrated with this, let's say they are judged to be the newspaper photographer of the year that year, it's something they keep with them for the rest of their life. It certainly is something that defines them in this industry. It's one of those things it's almost becomes part of your name. And that's pretty special. That's pretty, you know, unique. Cliff Eadem founded the photojournalism contest in 1943 with the first judging in 44, and Show Truth with a Camera was one of those quotes that we had on t-shirts as students here, along with a picture of him. And Show Truth with a Camera is a principle that basically means don't manipulate the image, show it as you took it. I think it has a real strong relevance now because of so much cell phone imagery is done with filters and things that distort the reality, and that's fine. You know, if it's fun, you know, you should do it, but it's not journalism. So we don't allow that in this contest. And so there is a distinction between where we come from with as far as how the contest was rooted and kind of that value that we hold to and the integrity we see by holding to it, because Show Truth at this camera is to show it, you know, life and news as it is. You document it, you don't cover it with a filter. It's really interesting to hear the judges talk about the images, because they can combine that, and it's kind of listening to poetry sometimes, because they can see the tragicness of some of the images, the power of the images, and also the beauty of the atmosphere that the photographer captures and how the photographer uses that atmosphere to support the mood within this tragic scene.
Wow.
And so it's quite moving, and it's heavy. It can be very heavy because, you know, there's a lot of bad news. And so this is a collecting point for all the photographers' work that they've done throughout the year. So, you know, we have our share of that heavy, you know, stuff.
So is that like some of the things that like the judges look for judging is like tragedy or emotion, or are they looking more for like aesthetics and like play of color, or is it just vary based on the judge?
I think there's some variation on the judges. You know, I think, you know, the things like aesthetics and composition are usually like the tools the photographer uses to create an emotional connection between you and the image. And so the judges take that into consideration. So we do discuss that. And when a class comes in, we'll break from the judging so that the judges then can talk about the process of judging or the issues that photographers face.
Is there anything else that you would like to say about like the competition or this whole month that's going on?
Well, so with this, you know, we bring in the judges from across the country and sometimes from other places in the world to take part. They volunteer their time. You know, we don't pay them anything to come here other than we get them here. But then they sit for like 8 to 12 hours a day pouring through this work. And then we have little breaks and chances to talk with these professionals and gain insight. So as a student, you know, it was incredible to see that. Even if I could not take directly part in that conversation, I could hear it. And then that really, you know, meant a lot to me at the time. So I think that's, you know, very happy to be able to be a part of it.
Thank you to Director of Pictures of the Year International, Lyndon Steele. Anyone can watch the Pictures of the Year International judging live on their Facebook page. There's a live stream plus videos, and really some of the images are just astonishing. We've posted a selection of former winners as well at kbia.org. Judging ends on February 22nd. We've got about 2 weeks to go before the True False Film Fest is in full swing, and there are 40 films at the fest this year. So the big question is, how to choose? On a recent episode of the True False podcast, the host Allison Kofelt talked with two programmers about the films. Here's Allison Kofelt talking with programmers Abby Sun and Chris Bachman.
I want to start by talking about feature films. What are you guys excited about for this year's festival?
One title that pops out to me is a film called America, which is a first-time feature from two directors who are actually not new to the festival, Chase Whiteside and Eric Stoll. But this feature is something they've kind of been working under the radar on for quite a while. It's a movie that they shot. They started by going down to Puerto Vallarta in Mexico because they were interested in the tourist industry that exists there. And they met this kid named Diego, who is working. He's like a young kid who is kind of working a variety of different sort of jobs in that industry. And they started following him. And one day he received a phone call that his father was actually being jailed for abuse of his grandmother, or elder abuse. So he had to sort of suddenly drop all of his jobs and move back to Colima with his older brother to take care of his grandmother and to help free his father. It's a movie that has a good sense of humor to it, and there are a few twists along the way as well. It's also just like one of the most kind of like tender observational documentaries we've seen in a while. You really find yourself falling in love with every single person that the camera latches onto.
Abby, what are you excited about?
So there's a film called Shirkers. This film played at Sundance just last month, and it's directed by a director who's originally from Singapore, but she now lives in the U.S., where she is a writer and a film critic. Her name is Sandy Tan. And when she was 19 in Singapore with some friends, she made what was one of the very first independent movies in Singapore. But they made this film under the guidance of a mysterious mentor whose name is George Cardona. And after they finished shooting the film, their mentor, George, left and just kind of absconded with all of the films. So they lost this for decades. And in this film, Sandy not only shares with us basically her childhood growing up in Singapore and how she was sort of a rebel and a punk girl who drew zines and things like that, but also what happened to her mentor and what happened to the film afterwards.
Hmm.
It's not only a great deal of fun, but it, I think, is a film that young people and old people will be able to enjoy a lot.
One movie I want to mention that's actually starting its life here at True False is a film called Black Mother, which is from a director named Kalik Allah. This time he's going to the country that his mother came from, Jamaica, which is where he spent a decent amount of his life kind of growing up visiting. And he's reconnecting with his grandfather while he's there, and learning a lot more about the sort of country. And he's looking at sort of a pretty wide array of topics, from the country's history of fighting for its freedom very early on, all the way to, you know, its relationship with the Christian church, and the currency of what it's like to be a sex worker in the country. And there are a lot of different things that are covered over the course of this movie, which is actually structured inspired by a woman that he's following as she's a pregnant woman as on her way to birth. So that is sort of the film's structural technique.
And then there are two films that I'm very excited about. They're also screening in the festival world for the first time at True False. The first one is called Combat Obscura, which was actually submitted to us. So this was a film that someone that we had no connection to before, they submitted, like paid money, like submitted through the website. First-time filmmaker, he is still in college. And this film is called, it's called Combat Obscura, and it's directed by a man named Miles Lugosi. And so I say that he's still in college. But he's actually not a traditional college student, because he spent 4 years in the Marine Corps as a combat cameraman. And Miles himself was deployed to Afghanistan multiple times, where he filmed for the Marine Corps the daily lives of the Marines in Afghanistan in the unit that he was embedded with. And in this film, he just shows us, he uses the footage that he shot for the Marine Corps in a way that I think provides a completely different perspective on his experience there. And so he uses his footage as well as footage from other combat cameramen that he gathers. And the whole experience is completely immersive. It's very sensorial, and it's quite disturbing. And for me, this was a very striking new voice. It's very rare for us to find something like this.
Cool. Okay. All right. And then you said there was one other one.
Yes. So the other film that I'm excited about is, this is also a slightly left of center, perhaps, choice, but it is a film called The Task. And this film comes to us from Chicago, so it's not too far from us, but its premise is completely unique. We are dropped in the middle of a conference which brings together a group of strangers who are trying to examine their own group dynamic. And this sounds really meta and a little bit strange, but things get heated really quick. People start accusing each other of being racist, of being sexist, misogynistic, but they also accuse each other of...
So it sounds like the internet.
Yeah, sounds like the internet, but they also accuse each other of not listening to each other, of talking over each other, just all of these things that in polite company we're not supposed to mention. But the purpose of this conference is to mention it and discuss it with each other. And then slowly throughout this film, we realize that not all of the strangers are on the same playing field. Some of them are actually employees of the conference, and they are essentially planted to stir up debate. It's a completely unique film. It's edited with great, great attention to gestures and to what people speak. When Chris and I watched it, we howled with laughter at parts. We also, like, were completely rapt. We also were completely disgusted at parts. This is a film that will inspire a lot of emotion.
I was going to mention another title, actually, that also offers an extremely distinct look at war, which is a movie called Of Fathers and Sons, which actually won the grand jury prize at Sundance a few weeks back. Of Fathers and Sons is a film from a Syrian director named Talal Durki, who now is based in Europe in Berlin. but he traveled back to the northern part of his country and embedded with a family of fighters for al-Nusra, whose politics are very much aligned with al-Qaeda. This is, you know, it's intimate observational filmmaking where you find yourself caring very deeply about this family, even though they would view the people who are watching the film in the United States as enemies in many ways. So the country itself, for sure. So it's a really harrowing movie that contains images that I have never seen in my life.
When I watched it in a theater, my mouth was open for half of the time. It was just incredible images. There's another Sundance title that we think is a can't miss, and it also addresses a slightly hot button issue these days. This film is called Bisbee 17 and is actually directed by a filmmaker who is based in Columbia, Missouri. His name is Robert Greene, and this is actually his
hometown.
Fifth film at True Falls.
Yeah, so the film is very much in sort of the spirit of Robert's past few films, in that he is going to a place and sort of instigating some sort of behavior, which he then documents. This time he goes to Bisbee, Arizona, which is a copper mining town.
Former copper mining town,
I should say, yes. And he's looking at a historical event that happened 100 summers prior to when he was filming this movie. So in 1917, there were a number of different immigrant workers who were rallying together to form a union, and the owners of the mines were not happy with that, so they rounded them up and shipped them all the way out into the middle of nowhere, just stranding them completely and kicking them out of the town. There are a lot of different sort of techniques that he uses throughout this film. There are artists who are doing sort of installations to acknowledge what's happened, and Robert himself is doing reenactments with people who are actually related to people who were involved in the deportation. And so, yeah, it's, I think it's the sort of movie where at the very end, it's, as it kind of zooms out and looks at this town, it like leaves you thinking about your own city and its own past. And it has it in Colombia, for instance, that we have ourselves not reckoned with, I think, in a lot of ways.
That was Allison Kofelt, host of the True False podcast, talking with programmers Abby Sun and Chris Bachman. You can subscribe to the True False podcast on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for joining us here on Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. And thank you to Director of Pictures of the Year International, Lyndon Steele. Also, thanks to Steve Kraske of KCUR's Up to Date, playwright Michelle Tyrene Johnson of the Green Duck Lounge, and journalist Glenn Rice. And of course, thanks to all the folks at the True False podcast. If you'd like to listen to this show again, visit us online at kbia.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where we are at Intersect KBIA. Our music is Montana Skies. Our producers are Abby Ivory Gagna, Elena Rivera, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, Haley Broughton, and Hannah Rodriguez. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM.